This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship. For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org or call 800-698-7884.
Welcome. Welcome to the Xenos Summer Institute, as well as to the workshop. Who here is this their first round at our Summer Institute? Very cool. I hope it's not your last. I hope it's enjoyable for you. First of all, I'd like to introduce myself. I'm Doug Patch. I'm the Division Coordinator of Adult Ministries. What Adult Ministries Division has in our church are all the post-college home groups. I think we get about 105 with plants and stuff. I lose track. Also the four main, or not main meetings, but the large meetings where the home groups come together for what we call our central teaching, our weekend meeting that happens in that main auditorium, that's also in the adult ministry division. And my home group ministry background is I've been in a home group in this church actually since the week I moved here in 1983 to start a sports medicine practice. Our dietitian was pretty, so I asked her out, and she asked me to Xenos. So I would love to say how pure my motives were to come to Xenos on that first time, but they weren't. In 1986, my wife and I were planted off of Dennis McCallum's home church. Here's my better half. I said, here's my better half. There we go. There she is. It's the one in the back. That's Harry up front. Nice little cutthroat. She caught fly fishing last week in on the Snake River. But we've been leading home churches together since 1986. And in spite of myself, the Lord has granted us five or six home group plants in that period of time. My wife is a fantastic evangelist, and he has certainly surrounded us with many great friends who have tolerated us and helped us grow in ministry, and right now presently we're leading with Gus and Sherry Fohas and have for a couple of cycles of plants and at least one more to go before we split that team up. So that's kind of a little bit of our ministry background. And I do want to point out that why we're here, I hope, is to begin to see that home group ministries provides an opportunity for us to really live out God's passion. If we see that the church's purpose is the Great Commission, is to evangelize and disciple, and to, in that, bring people to a relationship with the Lord such that they then are involved in bringing other people to a relationship with the Lord while growing spiritually mature too. And you see leading a home group as being in the center of that Great Commission like we do here, where our home groups, they replicate the Great Commission in their mission. It's just a mini church to reach the lost, to disciple young believers. That if we are doing that, we are at the very epicenter of God's will, of His purpose in history until He returns. No matter what else we accomplish in life, if we are involved in His ministry to the lost and to growing believers, we are doing the most significant work on the planet. And so what I want to talk about today is just how do we lead a home group such that it can have that kind of vision for the lost and help the young Christians have that kind of vision for the lost that they too lead people to Christ and help them grow in the Lord. We're going to look at some critical elements. These are more overview elements without getting into specific tools that are used, that our home groups typically use. Those tools I taught on a few years back in the Summer Institute, and by the name of that tape, and they're also on CDs, and I think the PowerPoint presentations too. They're down at the bookstore. These are some of the kind of the internal tools we use as home group leaders and as staff people in leading home groups. Today, I'm going to be talking about the principles that really undergird the use of those tools. Principles come first. But I just wanted you to know that's there in case you wanted more information. First of all, I think it's important we define what leading evangelism means. And in my perspective, leading evangelism is influencing other Christians to willingly and actively participate in personal evangelism. Influencing other Christians to willingly and actively participate in personal evangelism. Note, I don't think leading evangelism is us setting up programs and events that will attract non-believers off the street to come in cold. Do we do those things? Yes, to a much lesser extent than what this definition defines, but we do those things. But in a home group context, our goal is to help Christians develop an evangelism ministry in their own right. I also don't look at leading evangelism as training people to invite their friends, co-workers, teammates, etc., to bring them to church while the pastor in the pulpit wins them to Christ, or maybe in a private conversation afterwards. In fact, I was at an evangelism seminar 2 years ago in Pittsburgh, pretty excited about it. It's where my parents lived, and I went to the conference and eager to pick some things up. And for a while it was implicit and eventually explicit that what the church should be doing is training people how to invite their friends to church. And that it will be the pastor's and the staff responsibility to lead them to Christ through the message and possibly through some private time after the meeting. I was really incensed by this, as personally I think the Lord was too. I'm not sure where Peter's writing stopped at the priesthood of all believers, proclaiming the excellencies of him. That's all believers. The ambassadors of Christ that we all are. It was as if 1 Thessalonians had been ripped right out of the Bible. How did that church grow? Paul left 3 weeks after he founded that church. How did it ever grow if it wasn't for all Christians taking seriously the necessity of an evangelism ministry? And so leading evangelism is working with other Christians in our home group in a manner that they become complete evangelists in their own right, while we are also continuing a personal evangelism ministry as well. Well, what is the context that keeps evangelism going in a church, that just kind of keeps things rolling in the right direction? Again, I think we can look to Paul here for an answer. If we look at his 3 missionary journeys, really impressive. I at one time calculated the miles he must have covered, and I unfortunately blew away my hard drive, so I don't know anymore. Thousands of miles. Through various modes of travel that had to be very laborious, and I not being long on patience, I can only imagine what it felt like with all the energy he had to not get to where he wanted to go faster. Founding church after church, leading people to Christ in city after city, country after country, year after year. What a phenomenal evangelist. Incredible. But then, you know, you look at his exhortation to Timothy, probably in Paul's swan song, is possibly his last book. He says, "Now the things which you've heard from me in the presence of many witnesses, these entrust to faithful men who will be able to teach others also." What an amazing verse. In one verse, he speaks of 4 generations of discipleship, influencing one generation after another. I don't know about chronological generation, but generation in the Lord. And sure enough, when you read Paul's letters, what do you see? He is perpetually surrounded by colleagues, co-workers in Christ. Where did these people come from? They were non-believers that he led to Christ and then discipled. So they were active Christian workers and doing the same thing with their friends and neighbors and so on and so forth. That's where these people came from. So what does that look like today? Well, a mini look might be something like this, where Sue meets Chris in the neighborhood and leads Chris to a relationship with Christ, but then also knows the job's not done. We have to teach Chris how to walk in the Lord, and that walking in the Lord, according to the Bible, includes taking up God's cause. So Chris does that, and Sue begins to advise Chris in how to get in there with Sherry, who she's in there in an exercise class with, and indeed Chris winds up doing exactly what Sue has done with her. So Chris begins to teach Sherry how to reach out to her friend Jennifer. And so on and so on the process goes. That's 2 Timothy 2:2. That's evangelism going on all over the place in the context of a close discipling relationship. And so it's discipleship is the engine that drives evangelism. Discipleship. If our goal in doing church, whether on the large scale or in our home group, is to win people to Christ, and it stops there, we are going to fill our church with baby Christians who do not understand what it means to walk in the Spirit in the fullest sense, not as the Bible, not as the New Testament defines it. We must go beyond this. Our structures must include Christ's model for church that he left the disciples with. Us leading people to Christ, but then leading them to an active, excited walk with God. And so whether we're looking on the broad scale of the church or right in our home group, that passion that the Lord has for how church should be done through discipleship must be continued. And so as a result, in our church, home groups reflect that model. They're just a bunch of groups of people reaching out to friends and neighbors and family and coworkers and teammates, etc., while simultaneously discipling younger Christians to be doing the exact same thing and handing it down. It's just a big hand-me-down ministry like Paul describes in 2 Timothy 2:2. So let's take a look then. And what we see are some of the critical elements, and these are not the critical elements, because coming up to the morning session, I thought of another one I couldn't believe I didn't put in here, Luke 16. I just got done writing a letter to our fiscal support team about finances and reminding them of the relationship between giving and evangelism that Christ makes in Luke 16. That easily should be in here, but it's not. Right, losing my memory with my hair. So the first element then, home group leaders must win the home group to God's perspective of the mission of the church. For a home group to succeed in evangelism, the majority of the Christians there need to see what God's mission is for that group and agree with it. It's not enough that the leaders, the four sitting there or whatever, say, yep, this is what it's about. For that home group to get the job done, the majority of the believers there are going to need to grasp this and own it. Own God's cause for their own cause. And naturally, that's going to take some work, because the Christians in all of our home groups are all over the place in maturity, years in the Lord, and they could be 30 years in the Lord and still immature if they haven't been walking, and in ministry experience. But the beginning point is going to be in building this consensus, this agreement. Naturally, if that's not there, and you're sitting there with just yourself, maybe your spouse, maybe the other leadership couple or something of that nature that has that view, your first task will be to build that consensus. Because that home group needs to own God's purpose for the world, and there is nothing more exciting. To be in a group when you've got 20, 25 Christians excited about the Lord's work, not in word, but in action, We just got back from vacation, as you saw there, so I threw out a fast email to our group. We'd been gone for over 2 weeks. And I'm there, you know, hey, let me know what's going on out there. And I just get these flurry of emails about how people are getting together with so-and-so, the conversations that have occurred while we were gone. Please get back to us on Monday. Please pray for this, da-da-da-da-da. Oh, man, it was fantastic to see the group just galvanized around God's purpose in the world. That's really exciting. That's consensus. And I do want to make a qualification here that although the focus is on evangelism and discipleship, as I'm going to describe a little bit later, it doesn't mean we don't take care of the needs of the group. Things come up. Tragedies happen, like marriage. We've got, you know, ministries like marriage. And in our home group system, the home group leader does the marrying. The home group leader does the burying if there are funerals, which with the age of our population, typically it's parents of people that are in our church. We do the visitations in the hospitals. We do the meal plans for illnesses and things of that nature. And we often do that for the outreach of the people one of our members are reaching out to as well. So they can sit there and say, we don't even know these people. Yeah, but they know me. They trust me. They're helping you out. So I'm not saying we don't take care of the needs. We just never do that as a detriment to God's mission. We do it as part of God's mission. I mean, Clive certainly said it a lot more eloquently than I ever will, probably, that the social action is part of the message. It's just not the whole message. There's a point to it. And so there's some things that we should understand about consensus so we don't get frustrated, because otherwise we're going to think, okay, this makes sense. You know what? I'm going to sit down with just the believers in our home group, and I'm going to give them good, you know, neat little grab a few of these verses, have them look at them so that everybody agrees that this will be the mission of the group. It's not going to happen quite that fast. So let's understand some things about consensus. First of all, it's not automatic, and it has considerable inertia. So inertia is the internal force, if you will. It's the amount of force it takes to get a body at rest moving. The body at rest are people sitting there saying, feed me. The Lord is saying, I will do that, but only so you use that energy to go and serve in my cause. And so to get that rolling takes some effort. It just doesn't happen automatically. And it takes regular attention to. So, you know, that's one of the reasons we do our e-group in our home group. And every believer there knows it. That part of their role is to keep this ethos, keep this consensus going by keeping the airwaves going with discussions about outreach. We know the Spirit of God comes alongside us and reminds us to pray for these people because we're talking about it. So it's very important. I saw a movie years ago that I really liked, G.I. Jane. I've got a simple mind. Good guy wins, you know. But there was a scene in that movie, and I've got this video clip that kind of reminds me of what it is like as a home group leader to keep the ball rolling with evangelism, including kind of the difficulty that's associated with it there too. And the first time I saw the movie, the illustration really popped to mind. I mean, I think I was watching it with my wife, and I said, that kind of reminds me what it's like to get a home group moving and thinking in terms of evangelism and keeping it going. So if I can do this without messing up the technology too much. These are ship bumpers. They're pushing up sand dunes. Can it be done? Absolutely. Does it take a lot of people pushing to accomplish it? Yes. Did you notice some of those teams in the background? They were still pushing and it seemed to be going pretty easily. Sometimes it's like that. Things really get rolling, a lot of people are involved, and you know, and you realize I'm just not having to exert the kind of force that I did before. There's not the regular reminders and questions. In fact, people are just initiating all over the place. You know, what you can't see is what they're rolling against. They're rolling against gravity, an invisible force. We are rolling against the evil one. And probably his world system of values, as described in 1 John 2, is our greatest force that we're rolling against. And when I say we, I don't mean, leaders, we're trying to get the people in the group to reject the world system. I mean us first and foremost, and them as well. The evil one does not want a group full of Christians turned on for the Lord. The other force that's not shown, illustrated there, but we've illustrated in our own life, is our sin nature. Our own sin nature of selfishness. So, you know, considerable force came from Doug Patch last week. My wife, I come home from work, I am beat on Friday, and she's in discussion with somebody in the front hallway. It's the mother of one of the soccer kids. We got soccer out the wazoo in our family. And she's talking. I'm starved. I called her on the way home. I hope it's ready. I had worked out and hadn't eaten yet, and just I was not in a great mood for other reasons. She talked for 45 minutes, and I am stewing, you know. So anyways, it finally breaks up. We have dinner, and I'm there, you know. Oh, what am I saying? She invites her to dinner. All I wanted was a little peace and quiet. It had been an incredibly hectic day. So, you know, and being the other centered person I am, I'm worried that there's not even going to be enough food. I wish I could say that there's just no part of that that's true. Anyways, she's coming to home church Tuesday for the first time, and her son, who's, I think, a sophomore at my son's high school, went to the high school group last night, Tuesday night, with my son Jason. Now, you know, my sin nature, this would have never happened. So we've got other forces to push against in our own life and others' lives to see this consensus build. The other thing we need to remember is developing consensus is a process. Again, you can tend, perhaps like me, to be impatient and think that, hey, we talked about it once. I don't see why you're not doing it. You understood it. Why aren't you doing it? Maybe if we project that onto a whole group, they'll quickly pick up how frustrated we are. Now, I truly believe in the need to speak to the values, and both group-wide as well as in individual discipling context, to challenge the value systems that hold people back from appropriating God's value system. And I think that's a big part of developing consensus. One by one, working with people that they value what God values. But it takes time. Well, what happens if you look, you know, and you realize, you know, what the consensus of evangelism is in this 20-person group? It's my wife and I. And yeah, we'll start to build in and start to do some things, but boy, it's going to be a long time before we see any evangelism around here. Somebody handcuffing you from doing it? Then we start with ourselves. We start with the neighbor. We'll get into the modeling part in a few minutes, but the starting point is wherever you are at. The goal is a majority in consensus, but the starting point is wherever you are at the moment. And then finally, we have to understand, and I know we do, but in the context of this seminar, it's important, workshop, this is ultimately developed by God. A group gels around His vision because of the way His Spirit moves in individual lives. And yes, we have a role. Speaking the truth in love is an imperative. We must speak the truth in love. But for that person's values to change, for them to eschew their worldly values and want God's, it's going to be because God changes their heart. We are not the Holy Spirit. And so as we help work with people in our group to develop this consensus, we need to really be trusting God, and most of all, we need to be verbally pointing them to God. And as they maybe argue with us, no, I'm fine, I'm sure my values are good, there's no need to fight. The big G's got a lot bigger bat than we do. You know, well, would you be willing to pray about it? Well, yeah, I'll pray about it. That's fine, right there. And it doesn't mean we don't ever go back to the topic with individuals, but again, we have to remember that it is God who causes the growth. We water and we plant. We have a role, and this whole workshop really is about our role. So I'm taking a little bit of time on this now. I'd love to give a balancing point for every point. We don't have time. But we know it's God who causes the growth in evangelism. We know it's God who empowers us to even do the watering and planting. Even though we have a role, He's the one empowering us to play that role. So we know where our adequacy comes from, and it's from Him. We had a problem in our home group with evangelism, very significant. We had planted a group in January of 2000. And we were looking in January of 2001, realizing the last 7 months we had not had first-timers in our group for 5 out of the 7 months of home group meetings. So I saw that, became very concerned, as did the other leaders. And we did some things. We spoke on these kind of issues, values, et cetera, et cetera. We called a spade a spade. We handed the group a chart that showed our outreach over the past year and said, how do you think our outreach is doing? And somebody kind of ventured the cautious, looks like it kind of, you know, is bad. And I'm there, yeah, I'd use another term, but we'll leave it at bad. And so a few excuses were thrown out. They were summarily rejected by other members. I didn't even have to speak up. And then we did a mini-series. We did some training. We did some stuff on building close relationships as a outreach mini-series for our home group, followed it with a common objection series. Anyways, about 2 years later, we were looking, kind of doing a history. Things seemed to correct itself, but then we were looking to see just how much. We had 25 months in a row with outreach. We had a month where we had 16 first-timers to our home group. One of them I sat down to teach. I thought I sat in the wrong room. It was my house, so I was certain I was in the right place. But and so we had a workers' meeting, and I asked, you know, so what do you think happened? And they're, oh, it was the mini-series. I know it was the mini-series. That's when they really started coming out. I'm there, well, actually, they've been coming out for well over a year and a half before that. But I find it interesting we did that mini-series in 1998, and we got 2 first-timers in 8 weeks. Well, maybe the teaching was better. And I'm there, well, maybe they were better, but they came before they knew that. You know, I mean, so, and I'm there, guys, God causes the growth. I don't really know why this is happening now, except to say God causes the growth. What did He do in the lives of those people we're reaching out to? We had a role. I don't think that would have happened if we'd been sitting on our duffs. I'm sure it wouldn't have. He won't bless that. But who is the cause? We can never forget that. And please, let's not forget it as we get into specifically our role in this kind of thing, helping members acquire God's purpose for the group. And I first want to say there's no formula. No formula at all. People having a vision for God's mission just happens one person at a time while working with people. But to develop this, one thing we do need to do is we need to teach on it. We need to teach in a couple areas. We need to teach not just that God has a heart and plan for reaching the lost, but that it is through the church, the assembly of the called out ones. His plan A for reaching the lost is a Christian showing Christ's love and verbally witnessing about Christ's love to another individual. That's his plan A. And there is no plan B. This happens, and then he comes back. And so we must teach to help build consensus. The starting point is for them to see this is God's heart, not Zenos's heart, not your heart, not your church's heart. This isn't about man-made mission. Gee, we just decided to kind of make this the mission statement, so to speak, of the church. This is where God's heart is at. We don't direct their attention to man-made institutions, nor to our compelling argument. We take them by the side of the head and we crank their head up and say, this is his view. And then we also teach that exchanging their agenda for the Lord's is the ultimate fulfilling life service. There is nothing they will do that is more fulfilling than this. And it is worth the sacrifice. And there will be a sacrifice of agenda. I can be a neurosurgeon and save lives, and probably would almost every day of my life. And if I lead one person to Jesus Christ, I have done something to change the very fabric of eternity that all my surgeries did not do. They must become convinced of that. And again, that's an issue between them and God. However, we have a role to play. So for our home group to effectively reach the lost, the majority need to develop God's passion for the lost, and they need to see and have his passion for helping young Christians grow and develop that same passion and make it a hand-me-down ministry. The second critical element is home group workers must be committed to building relationship with Christians and non-Christians outside of the meeting structures. Outside of any meeting structure. So here's a couple scenarios. You got a home group, hasn't been seeing many non-Christian guests for a while. Those that come don't come back. And it's been kind of a protracted problem. 9 times out of 10, all we have to do is start saying, so tell us about the people in your group, individuals. Let's talk about who you consider your most mature Christians and tell us about how they are using their time to build friendships with Christians outside of any meeting. And that's usually what you get. Silence. And you find out there's very little time being spent by Christians building friendships with non-Christians. They'll invite them to the meeting, so you get a few that show up. Well, they came to the meeting. I don't know why they didn't come back. Are you their friend? Well, I wouldn't say that. Why not? What better way to spend a Friday evening? What's better way to spend? I mean, why play golf with 4 Christians? You know, play with one other and get a couple of non-Christians there. Or we often see the scenario where maybe they have been successful in outreach, but then the younger Christians don't seem to be stepping forward in ministry, don't seem to be stepping forward in getting equipped to do the Lord's work. And sure enough, the group grows, gets to 40-some people, and there's no plant of a new group in sight because there's no Christians that have matured enough to lead the next group. And that typically happens simultaneously through discipleship. So you begin to ask the same question now about discipling ministry. Who do you have that's getting together regularly with younger Christians to help them grow and develop ministry? And silence follows. And so, you know, Danny is the consummate guru of home group oversight in this church. And, you know, is this not one of the things you would... I mean, I'm probably exaggerate with the 9 out of 10 times on this, but it can't be too far from that.
You're right on the money.
And why is that? Because people get what we call a meeting mentality. I've gone to home group. I've gone to central teaching, and our home group has a small men's Bible study. Every other week I go to that. You know, that's busy enough. Well, That does make one a little bit busier, but it does not develop a Christ-centered relationship with our lost neighbor or with our coworker. And so this is absolutely mission critical. And a qualification I do want to make here is when I talk about outside of meeting structures, I'm not talking about, okay, we need to plan some parties, some outreach events, some sporting events to invite non-believers to. Again, those are structures. I'm talking about something that's just in the fabric of our life. You know, what does this look like? Well, what do you do with friends? You know, I love soccer. I go to crew games. And I go to a million of my kids' games. You know, I exercise. What kind of things are you into? The arts, going for walks, grilling outside, going out to dinner, checking out movies. Well, whatever you do in the context of your friendships, you would do in the name of the Lord. So if it's a friendship with a non-believer, it's going to include witnessing. And if it's in the context of somebody that's in your home group, going to be helping them get on with their walk with the Lord. Gary's tape, Gary DeLashman's tape from the Summer Institute a few years back, or last year, is about discipleship, and it's at the Study Center, which is open throughout the conference. And if you're wondering where our Study Center is, you really ought to check it out. It's very cool. You just walk down that path across the, just head south. Follow the path, run into the back of our building, and you ran into the Study Center. It's very cool, but he gets into more specifics on discipleship. What does this actually look like in someone's lifestyle? Well, I'll tell you what Chris and I do. And I am not by any means prescribing this as, well, therefore you ought to be able to keep up with the patches or anything like that. Don't take it that way. Our life situation has a little bit more freedom. Our boys are 14 and 17 now. I can get babysitting by saying bye. you know, that kind of thing. So we're all different. But I get together with five guys weekly. I double them up. So on three breakfasts, on Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday, I'd get together with guys for a discipling relationship. We meet at 6:15. We hang out till about 7:45, always ending with prayer. Those discussions include counseling because we had a fight with our wife, the ministry, their personal ministry, health, ideas, suggestions, the health of the home group. Prayer, always we end in prayer. Study of content, we're usually reading books on the outside and then just talking about it when we come in there. And fun stuff. Some days, you know, we'll just sit and we'll just talk about the Browns, which hasn't been a lot of fun lately. Needless to say, we're getting into better and better content as the Browns go down the tubes. My wife does the same stuff with the spouses of those people. We feel that it's really important whenever possible that if I'm going to be involved in helping a younger Christian grow, that my spouse be with their spouse so we can help with marriage issues and things like that, just in case they ever come up. The other thing we do is we keep our Fridays and Saturdays completely open, Friday and Saturday nights. We don't schedule any non-Christian connection for those nights until the last minute. Until we just nothing has worked out to get together with outreach. We try to get together with outreach at least every 2 weeks, if not more frequently. And if we're going to be spontaneous with our schedule and drop something at a moment's notice, it'll be for outreach. And we just find keeping those slots open is good. We don't always fill it that way. And there's times where I'm there, fine, nothing's going on, tell you what. I am going to fix that fence before I kill myself the next time I mow the lawn. So I'll go out and get some house projects done. But it's the house projects. It's my garden that suffers. You know, it's my conditioning that suffers. I don't work out like I used to. I still work out, just not as much. I don't play three softball leagues a year. My wife doesn't run constant marathons anymore because the investment is just too great on those things. So we edge back there to replace it with something more significant. We must get in there with people. We must. Home group leaders also need to equip their members to do evangelism. Kind of awkward to ask somebody to do something they don't know how to do. We kind of discovered that. We were surprised that although our people were inviting people to home group, we weren't ever seeing those people come back, or seldom. And we kind of call that special little niche follow-up. It's just basically hanging in there with the person for the long haul. Well, we really never did talk about the importance of hanging in there. People thought the job was done. Our bad, leadership mistake. We've noticed that great evangelists have a couple of capabilities. First of all, they have figured out how to incorporate building these friendships that we just talked about in the prior principle into their daily or regular schedules. It's really part of their lifestyle to get together with non-Christians whenever possible. They have figured it out. Some are just good at administrating time, but I think it's also behooves us as a church, either church-wide or within the home group, to teach about time stewardship. We're asking for a very sophisticated ability to manage time. When we're saying, make the Lord's agenda your agenda, don't worry, I know you still have to work, I know you still have a family, you do need to rest, etc. Right? So let's help people do that. Teaching it and discipling it, frankly, again, and that's where you bring those principles just in the context of a friendship. And we've taught seminars and workshops and things like that on this subject. So I think it's important that we not just expect people to figure this out. Effective evangelists do this. Effective evangelists also, you know what you see them doing? They're constantly reading about how to become more effective evangelists. They kind of have this sense. My wife's this way. She just doesn't have the I've arrived sense. She's very good. She has a very wonderful approach at communicating the gospel, drawing people into spiritual conversations. You know, we got home a couple of weeks ago. I got out of the car. She got out on the right side. Our neighbor Nick was standing there holding his dog on a leash. I came around the car and walked up and, hey, Nick, how you doing? And I interrupted their spiritual conversation. And I wish I could say, oh, that's just Patch exaggerating. I am not exaggerating. Yeah, I'm, how the heck did you do that? Oh, he's still standing there now. You know, so I think it's very important that we constantly strain at the oars to become better communicators of the gospel. And I think connected with that is developing our defense for the faith, as Peter calls for us to here. So she's regularly reading books on defense or apologetics, common objections that our culture throws up. Trying to understand the mind of the non-believer, trying to figure out how to respond to those things in a manner that draws them to, not throws them away from Christ. I think this is another thing, and again, we can approach this church-wide, and we do that here, but then also, I think within the home group context, this makes for great kind of material to do in the context of a small men's or women's Bible study as a subset to your home group. And certainly in discipling relationships, again, discussing these things. I always forget to click that one. Okay. So we should be equipping and discipling in apologetics too. Now, one qualification I'm making here is important. I am not saying we shouldn't witness and we shouldn't teach people not to witness until they're well equipped. I am not saying that. If the Spirit of God is inside of them, they're well equipped. In fact, some of our best bringers don't even know the Lord yet. And that's just a fact. We get stories constantly about, oh yeah, this non-believer brought three people. You got to check out this Bible study. It's awesome. And we're just sitting there going, okay, when are you going to maybe consider this? But what I am saying is the Bible supports the relationship between knowledge and effectiveness in His work. The relationship between knowledge and the depth of our walk with Him. And there's no way to have one discussion about our walk with Him and another discussion about evangelism and discipleship ministry as if those are two completely separated things. We aren't walking with Him if we aren't involved in His purpose. The fourth element we want to look at is that home group leaders must lead evangelism by doing evangelism. And so kind of the pointed question, are we experiencing the power of God as we witness to our friends and family? What non-Christian friends, co-workers, teammates, etc., do we regularly get together with? Not just regularly, purposefully regularly, knowing that this is going to be part of this relationship very soon. Are we witnessing? And witnessing is not, you know, yeah, I go to church. Yeah, I just look to God for those things. Hey, I witnessed last night. Witness means to give a testimony to what Jesus Christ has done, to give an account for our faith. Are we doing that? Are we experiencing His power in that area? How can we call on the people in our home group and church to do something that the Lord calls on all Christians to do, regardless of gifting? This is an area of uniformity in ministry. If we're not doing it as well, where is the moral authority, the credibility? Where, practically, how do we advise them how to incorporate this into their busy lifestyle? If we're not trying to incorporate it into our busy lifestyle. A lot of the things we've learned about time stewardship, we've learned the hard way of just trying to do it. How can we help them figure out where to go with this person next? How to respond to that hostile response if we haven't been in those shoes too, or something similar? Now, this is absolutely critical. This is one of the first places we go with home groups that aren't doing well in evangelism, is we just say, how's your evangelism ministry doing? And oftentimes, then our next question is, how can we help? Because they sit there and admit there's nothing there. So, a side note, paid staff should do this on their personal time, not counting toward work hours. You know, oh, I went out to lunch with three non-believers today. Man, I knocked off 6 hours of work. I'm out of here. And frankly, we have the same view with discipleship. We try not to ask. We don't ask anything from the workers that have professional lives outside of the church. We don't ask them to do something that we aren't doing. I've got to figure out how to work that stuff in. That's why my watch is set at 5:35, 5 mornings a week. I get together with guys in the morning before any of us go to work. I want to sleep in. And I'm not great shakes. I'm just saying, some way, somehow, we've got to figure this out. And we can't ask others to do something we're not. And even a more of a side note, our home group consultants, our leaders who do this as well, including leading and planting groups. I listened to Carl George's tapes. In fact, I just transcribed them probably about 10 years ago, was it, for you, Danny? And, you know, I was appalled that his method has home group consultants, he calls them coaches, not leading home groups because they're too busy to do that and consult multiple groups. Oh, man. Well, I consult 9 groups, and I'm the division coordinator for a large division. I usually teach our Christian principles class. That's another 12 hours a week. We're all stretched in multiple directions. But the only thing I know to say to those 9 groups, I have a lot to come out of my experience as a home church leader that's been ongoing through the years. And so this is kind of necessary for the consultants that we have on staff. And I'm not going to get into details on how we consult, but John Cleary's workshop is excellent on describing our approach to home group oversight. John Cleary. I was really struck by this quote. It's in your notes from Mark Middleberg's book, Building the Contagious Church. He says, "How important is this owning and modeling of evangelistic values by church leaders? It's everything. Unless you first catch God's concern for those outside His family, you may as well ignore the rest of the ideas in this book. Why? Because without a heart that beats fast for lost people, you won't have the foundation or spiritual resources needed to sustain evangelistic programs and ministries.
But if we grow bigger and bigger hearts for those who don't know Christ, and if we increasingly model this bold example of being a friend of sinners, then those around us will take their cues from us, and they too will begin to take strategic relational risks for the sake of the gospel. I read that, I think it was 3 years ago, maybe two and a half years ago, walking our path here, get a real nice mile loop around the place, and I was so struck by it because I realized, although certainly my dear wife could read that and go, I agree completely, I had to read it and say, I agree completely, and I am not doing. I'm doing evangelism catch as catch can. I'm a faithful servant in discipleship. I go the extra distance to help lead the group and things. But when it comes to getting in there with the non-believer and witnessing, I was pitifully poor. Not completely absent, but definitely. I knew the Spirit of God was saying, we're talking about you here, Patch. So I felt so convicted. And I got excited. With that conviction then, God's grace came, and I'm there. This is changing now. First of all, my wife will control our schedule on evangelism. And if you think that's easy for me to hand over control in any place. And I was excited about that because I knew she'd get us in the thick of things the way she has been. And I continued to pray, and all of a sudden, the Lord just kind of laid Ed and Ruth on my mind. I'm there, all right, Ed and Ruth. We're going home tonight. They're our neighbors. I'm going over there, and I'm going to invite them out. It's their Saturday. I have no choice with Saturday. Friday. Okay, we're canceling that. We're doing this instead. Friday, if they can go out. If not, we're going to Nick and Lynn or somebody else. So I'm all excited about this. I even just set the time in my mind. I've talked to nobody. You know, it's like, okay, by 5:30, we can get out with Ed and Ruth. So I get home, and I am really excited. In fact, I called my wife, and I said, I can't wait to tell you. Something really cool has happened to me between me and the Lord. I feel bubbly about this. So anyways, I get home hours later, and she goes, oh, I can't wait to tell you what happened. And I'm there, hey, I called, me first. And then I looked into her eyes, and I thought, let Chris talk. She won't hear a word I say. She goes, did you bump into Ruth on the way over here? And I'm there, no. She goes, oh, well, she just left. She came over here. She's going to do a surprise birthday party for Ed. And she wants us up at some sports bar around here. It was at 5:30 on Friday. Could we cancel this thing and go to that instead? And I said, you know what? Now I'm more excited than ever to tell you what I had to say because you just made the story better. I think when we come clean with the Lord on this, he just goes, grace upon grace is to just provide a bajillion opportunities. The fifth critical element is home group leaders must plan for planting. Yeah, Dubs.
Can I stick in something on point four? Where,
please.
William Fay's book, Share Jesus Without Fear, has been a really helpful book to a lot of people who found that, you know, they're completely rusty on sharing Jesus and that fear's taking a bigger role than it did when they were in college or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Share Jesus Without Fear by Fay. So,
very good. Yeah.
Yeah, it's downstairs.
Yeah, that's
and at the study center.
That's going around this church like crazy right now. Good call, Dubs. Thanks. We must plan for planting a new group from the beginning. You know, if the people in your group are sharing Christ, people are coming to Christ, they're getting involved in biblical fellowship, your home church, your group's going to grow. How big's your house? I can get about 55, 60 people in our, but we had our basement finished for home church purposes, and that's big. We probably won't ever let our group grow that big before we plant. I hope we don't. How many younger Christians in your group do you think are really going to experience where they are spiritually gifted and really develop a strong ministry while the old fart leaders are still there leading? Now, if we're fulfilling the Great Commission, we're going to need to plant a group from this group. And when they grow, they're going to need to plant too, as will we. So on and so forth. But we must begin to plan for planting right away and communicating to the group. We planted off a group in the end of August last year, and our first workers' meeting, and theirs too,
I heard, we requested prayers of the group members as the leaders begin to discuss planting, plans for planting. And they're sitting there going, wait a second. We had 42 people. We've got a good 18 people here now. Aren't we a few years away from that? Well, we'll be a lot more than a few years away from it if we don't start planning for it right now. And there are some critical ways this helps. Emotionally and relationally, planting's kind of tough. You know who was planted off as leaders on our plant was Brent. I led Brent to Christ in 1986. He went off on a plant with another guy, but he came back to our home group in 96, and I'd been getting in there weekly with him and I helping each other grow, since 1996, weekly. And now he's gone on a home group. My little boy. Anyways, you know what? I miss Brent. I miss him on Tuesday nights when home group meets. I miss him on cell group nights, our small men's Bible study. He's not there. We're kind of kindred spirits. We were friends instantly. When he was a pagan, he still was a hunting and fishing pagan. We were friends instantly. You know, it's tough, plants. It's just necessary. It's a sacrifice we have to make. But we can help the home group by preparing them for that eventuality by continuing to talk about planting. And on a practical level, it enables us by planning from the beginning to discern and wisely act on what the group needs in order to grow and plant. Why does it do that? Well, I was trying to decide whether or not to fly out west for vacation or drive. So I looked at my two cars. One is a 1995 Honda Civic with 149,000 miles, and I realized this can make it easily. It's just barely broken in. The problem is it's not going to carry four people with the luggage we need for 2 weeks and 2 days of vacation. So that's out. Hey, I've got this newer Ford Explorer. It only has 107,000 miles on. Of course, it's about ready to die because it's domestically made. And so I can't take it either. And what made me realize that would have had to have been the vehicle of choice. And I started thinking of all the things I would have to do to prepare that car to be out to go out there and back. And I thought, you know, I don't have that kind of money. I barely had the money for the vacation, let alone to, you know, do this to this car. So when we begin to see where we're headed, we can more clearly see what it takes to get there. And so if you wait till you have 30, 40 people sitting in your home group before you sit there and go, whoa, it's packed. We better figure out how we're going to plant this. Oh, I can't even begin to describe in this workshop the trouble, the world of hurt you are in. You're going to have relationships all crossed up. There's just all sorts. You're going to have people. You're not going to realize that your best people aren't even ready to lead. Nobody took the classwork. Nobody developed ministry yet. Oh, my goodness. What are we going to do? All of that could have been averted by thinking this way from the very beginning. And, you know, here's a tool, the one tool I will bring. Oh, you know what? I did it again. I thought I won't forget this. Is it a 50s forgetting thing or is it? You know, Rick. That's an ex-friend. All right. Here's a ministry chart. Looks like MS organization chart, but it's not really. It's 2 Timothy 2:2 on paper. This is what we use to see whether people are investing in people. So this was our home group before, about a year before we planted. Gus and I are leaders, and my wife are, Sherry, Gus's wife, and mine. Tell nobody. Oh, my God, this is copied. You know, and if you look at this, you'd sit there and say, oh, Doug's getting in there with Matt, Brent, and Mike. Brent's getting in there with Kevin, Dave, and Bill. Kevin's in there with Doug, so on and so forth. And our little symbology means something to us. But one thing it does do, it keeps us from having people in the group that other Christians aren't trying to get in there with. See, we believe in discipleship. And it's very possible. I mean, we've got like 31, 32 people in our group right now. I can't keep track of that. I can't keep track of my car keys. How do I know if this key ministry of discipleship is happening? We write it down. Now, how do you decide who disciples who? Really easy. Friend from, I do a half a day of physical therapy. Friend from physical therapy ages ago. He was unattached when he came to the group 10 years ago and had similar interests. You know, usually it's just based on the friends that you bring around. That's who disciples, right? So anyways, the value of this, first of all, kind of keeps our heads straight on relationships. And I was so excited before we planted, we had this kind of 2 Timothy 2:2 four-generational look there for a while. Those lines, the solid lines in this particular chart, means they're getting together with that person weekly out there on their own, breakfast, lunches, or whatever. I would consider that healthy. Then we took the exact same chart and said, now how do we want to plant this group? And so we were able to just play around with MS org chart and say, well, let's see here. If we keep the existing leaders together, so it's still the Fohases and the Patches, and send off the top workers who have already developed ministry. We know they have ministry because we saw they have ministry. This is what their church would look like, just on paper. And we began to sit there and go, wow, that's a lot of discipling relationships. Boy, that sometimes groups are out there a year or more before they see that. And that's, you know, that's more than a dozen people. The box means they're in a small men's Bible study or small women's Bible study getting further equipping. My goodness, committed people. We're taking this to the elders for approval for the plant. And we call this a mission plant because we send off, in this case, all new leaders, all new people. We could have split the Fohases from the Patches and mixed it up. In this case, Brent is probably spiritually gifted in leadership. I'm almost convinced he is, and there's no sense us remaining together. He needs to get out there and flap his wings a little bit and see what happens. So that kind of tipped the scales for doing a mission plan. But that's one key tool that also visually illustrates. So in our discussions about what the group plant needs, you've got questions in your notes that we typically ask. We'll sit there and say, okay, now if we do this, who has a good active, you know, evangelism ministry? And we look and we realize there's good strengths. Who will be the teachers on the two sides? We don't want to overwhelm any one person, you know. And if we do that early enough, well, then we're developing those things over the course of the growth of the group. So when it's big enough to plant, you just set a date and you plant. Sometimes it even happens that way. It's always the goal. The Lord sometimes requires flexibility. And you can look at that list of things that we do to help communicate and inculcate this planting ethos. Let's go on to number 6. Home group leaders must stay forward thinking and forward moving even when pressed with legitimate distractions from the main mission. You see a kind of a slice of that in Acts 6. You can read the passage and see what happened there. What we need to do and typically see with home groups that are up on blocks in evangelism is we start asking them, so tell me a little bit about, what do you talk about in your leaders' meetings? And you find out they talk about the sin problems that are there, scheduling teachings, planning parties. Oh, wow, okay. What we typically find is that it's easy to get focused on the urgent problems that come from counseling issues, sin issues that come up in the group, sometimes serious enough to require formal church discipline. A lot of that takes interaction with staff to get some insight and counsel before you act on things. A lot of negative things, and I call them legitimate because in the fallen world with our sin nature, these things are going to happen. We can't sit there and go, well, there should just never be sin in the home church. We should just keep doing evangelism. Well, there's going to be sin. You know, and then there's even dissent. I have never gone through a cycle of in a home group where there aren't members of the church that are ticked off usually at me, being the more outspoken one. Somehow it all comes on me. I keep trying to point them to my wife, complain to her. But, you know, it's about structure. We meet too early. We meet too late. We have too many parties with the kids present. We can't have any good discussions. We don't have enough parties with kids present. We do too much evangelism. We don't do enough. I mean, you know, and that's just the way it is. I look at every one of those as an opportunity to help this person grow in their insight in what it takes to do home church leadership, because I hope someday they're leading a home church. And I consider, no matter how nastily said, there may be some truth there. And so I try to get to the core if there is truth there or not. Just be defensive. These things take time. They take time away from Ed and Ruth and Nick and Lynn. But they are legitimate. And the groups that struggle often struggle because the leaders can't do both. They feel, they kind of invert Galatians 5:16. It says, if you walk by the Spirit, you will not carry out the desires of the flesh. They kind of approach it as, if we get people from carrying out the desires of the flesh, we'll walk by the Spirit. We'll grow when people stop sinning. No, we'll grow because we walk by the Spirit. The limp will go away when we focus on the right way to walk. And that's where we need to keep the focus while attending to those issues. And I made that point before. They're not ignored, but there's ways to help stay on track. One of those, and this is between us and the big G. So is Paul more worried about pleasing man or pleasing God when he wrote to the Galatians? He tells us explicitly, I'm not worried about pleasing you. I'm worried about pleasing God. Read the implication. I don't care if every one of you are alienated from me in relationship. I will bring God's truth to bear on this issue. What about Caleb? In the book of Joshua, I don't think that guy was gifted in leadership. Paul probably was. Caleb, pretty laid back and everything. This is what I'm going to do. If you wish to follow, that's between you and God. God's purpose is my purpose. I hope he's your purpose. There won't be any arguments if that's the case, but God's purpose is mine. A leader must be willing to please God even if it results in displeasing man. We either take our cues from God or cues from man. Now, oftentimes, praise God, we're surrounded by mature people who want God's will as much as us, and what do we have? Consensus, right? But it's not necessarily going to be there. And if we think we're going to put out all fires and have everybody happy with everything this group does before we move out on something we believe God wants us to move out on, we're sadly mistaken. That will not happen. Not in a fallen world. We need to train leaders to do basic biblical counseling. So we have coursework we do this through. We reinforce it often in our small men's and women's Bible studies, and as well as in our discipling relationships. So when somebody asks me about a problem they've got in their marriage, my goal is to help them solve it themselves. Well, I know what I would do. I think you ought to da-da-da-da-da. I mean, we may get there eventually if they just don't quite get it, but I'd rather teach them the principles because they're meeting with somebody else tomorrow. I want them to understand how to help counsel others. So most of the counseling in this church happens in these discipling relationships. We have some professional counselors, but few. Most of it is done in the context of home groups. And most of it's done in one-on-one counseling. My wife just got done doing something like that with one of her best friends today. You know, just as a part of the friendship. She's struggling. She's struggling with some character issues. Wife gets in there with her and talks with her. Train leaders to manage conflict for obvious reasons. Teach God's heart for the lost and the purpose of the church. We already covered this, but in this context of staying forward moving, I like it a lot more when there's 20 people around me wanting to stay forward moving. And it's amazing how many fires I think we prevent just by people having already owned God's purpose. If you see them get aggravated, sometimes they get aggravated because of the distractions. I can't believe I'm spending all night counseling this person and, you know, I had to cancel an outreach opportunity. You know, okay, this is a serious issue, though. You did the right thing. That person's going nowhere, and you have to almost calm them out. But at least they understand forward moving is what matters. You know, please look at it this way. Maybe the sister's now more able to get her focus on outreach, too, because you helped her with that problem. But it's both. Continue doing outreach events, parties, outings, things of that nature, even if your home church is in some kind of a turmoil. We had an excommunication 2 summers ago. That robbed a lot of energy from our home group, a lot of time, too. It's a very serious matter. But there are some things we continued to keep going through that process so they did not lose sight of what really ultimately mattered. We should be intentional and consistent in talking about outreach among our group members via email, discipleship, Christian-only meetings. I try to get out an email or two per week asking the group for information. We have an e-group just for our home group, Christians only. Excuse me. Asking them for what's going on this week with their outreach. What can we pray for? And then early the fall, and then I share the same stuff about Chris and I. And then the following week, we're kind of reporting through the whole group. Hey, it was really cool. I had that conversation with Kara. She's really moving closer, and the wires are buzzing with this. Well, I think the prayer level of our group goes way up because of that, and that's possibly the main benefit. Some good advice comes through too. But the other thing that kind of excites me is that it just becomes more and more obvious to the group that this is what it's about. And whatever else is going on in their lives that's negative, again, it can be legitimate, but negative and difficult, they keep remembering what really matters. And I think the Spirit affirms that He's going to carry them through these things without them having to jettison God's purpose from their life. And leaders' meeting agendas need to focus on outreach, on follow-up, in other words, the ongoing relationships and discipleship, on who are the next leaders, what do they need, all these forward things. I this is the one area I wish I could just mandate with the groups that I have influence in to make them do this. I can't preach enough, and it doesn't happen. I'm not preaching the right way. What do you do with your leaders' meetings? Well, you know, we spent the whole time talking about so-and-so's sin. Oh, I thought you got together with that person weekly. Well, yeah. Just talk about it then. Well, we laid out the teaching schedule for the next 6 months. I do our teaching schedule away from that meeting. We don't need to tie up meeting time to do that. This is how we plan a party, an outreach party. A highly detailed, expensive one would sound like this. Somebody think we need to do a conversation cuisine soon? Yes. Okay. Somewhere in October? Yes. Remember, relational topic. Right. Great food. Right. Okay. That's the end of the discussion. The rest gets administrated out there. It's not about management. It's about effectively leading people into an evangelism and discipleship lifestyle. And when we're together as leaders, that's the place to talk about that, not to manage the details of the administration of a meeting. Okay, off that soapbox. And last, home group structures must put non-Christian at ease. Here's a question for us. Church-wide, or our own home group, are we more committed to edifying the Christians or non-Christians by what our structures communicate? So that's something to think about here. What are we more tuned to? I'd like us to think about the non-Christian we've invited to home group. Unless it happens to be a non-Christian that's coming to your house for a home group, most of our guests are going to somebody's house they do not know the person's person. They're going to be asked to study the Bible in somebody's house, something they've never done before. Surrounded by Christians, which they are not. They will know very few of those Christians. So now, the very fact that they do come is obviously a work of God. Yeah. Why would we want to throw up any impediment to them hearing God's best foot? How does God put his best foot forward at a home church meeting? The Word of God. We would want nothing to interfere from them hearing from him. We want to blow away expectations, particularly. So what kind of things are we talking about? A great, not good patch, great fellowship environment. What kind of environment would that be? Good non-Christian music. Good non-Christian music playing before and after the meeting. That's non-Christian music. What, do we think that somehow it infuses them as we're in conversation with them and they get saved by it? Of course not. That edifies us, which is great. That can prepare us for a great meeting. That can get us in the spirit and moving forward thinking when people start to arrive. Let's play their music before and after the meeting. Having a great hangout area. If you have a deck in weather like this, get the deck furniture out, get some citronella torches, get a little fire pit, whatever. We go to great lengths of trying to make a real neat environment so when the amen is said, people want to hang out longer. We have awesome snacks and beverages, not bags of chips and a little bit of pop. People go out of their way. Often they bake things. Sometimes I think there's contests or something, which is fine. I don't want to discourage that. But again, we make a big to-do out of it. Keep the temperature comfortable. I'm as anal about spending money on power and water as can possibly be. I hate cranking my AC. But boy, at home church night, we're going to have 30-some people. They're going to heat up the house. I put it at 67. I freeze that house. And it gets up to comfortable while people are there. I hate spending the money. But I've got my problem. I got a higher electric bill. They got theirs. They're going to hell. I want them to be comfortable. I want them to stay. We don't clean up till people are gone. Boy, when I see somebody new kind of go, oh, help, and they start stacking chairs, it's like, don't do that. Don't communicate. It's over. We teach. We start at 7:30. We're done with teaching, sharing, and praying usually by about 8:30. And then people hang out for at least a couple of hours. I don't want to hasten that. Sometimes they'll hang out till midnight or even later. That's not common with the field that we're reaching out to. And we should consider logistics that keep in mind our field. So what time generally works best for them? We just shifted our home church a little earlier to 7:30. We're seeing people hang out longer afterward because we have 18,000 children connected with our home church. And it was 36,000 before we planted off the McGee's. So, you know, they got to go get their babysitters. And I can't fight that. It's a weekday night. It's some guy or girl from the neighborhood has to be home by 10. Okay, so let's get things started a tad earlier. Considering those kind of logics, we don't do babysitting in home group. I've tried it. I've tried it 80 different ways to have kids there, and every time I'm sitting there going, great timing, kid. We'll get to the gospel next time we talk. You know, and it's that kind of thing. And if we don't even think the evil one times things certain ways, we're really being foolish. So in our home church, if you have an infant, bring them. If they're nursing, bring them. And I just tell parents, when you're comfortable leaving them with the babysitter, then I'd like you to. And what we do is the nursing mothers stay upstairs, we're downstairs. They put a reverse baby monitor on so they can hear the teaching. And then I love parenting and everything else, so I kick the dad in the butt as soon as the teaching's over to go and relieve mom so she can hang out with adults for a change. And so that's as far as we go where the kids are concerned. And I use the phrase here as far as possible with logistics because there's some things that the Bible mandates. They mandate that our fellowship express the love of Christ. So that means it's going to go a certain length of time. It means it's going to be a certain frequency to live those principles out. We're not going to have home church once a month and think that we're building close relationships, that kind of thing. And then finally, and possibly the biggest structure, and it's not really that, it's an attitude. It's a godly attitude, but it's one that we teach. is we want our believers, when the amen is said, to be completely other-centered. It's not about them. We don't want them clicking out with their buddies. I don't want to hang out with Mike and Gus, my best friends in the group. For goodness sake, I see them every Friday morning. It's about the guest, is what that means. I'm going to meet the new people. I want our people scattering. And I'll tell you, I get really excited. Oftentimes, almost every week, I'll sit and just see the conversations. And I'll realize that she is very shy, went over and talked to the guest that so-and-so brought. And that wasn't easy to do, but she was being other-centered. And she got over there. And she made that conversation about that person's interest, not her own. I find that really exciting to see a group of 20, 30 Christians into others. That's what that night should be like. That is the mystical witness of the body. When that person leaves and later gets baptized because they got saved and says, I just experienced something very different, very genuine. What they experienced were people not into themselves, but into others. And that probably happened that very first night. So, most aspects of home group structures are matters of taste, not biblically mandated. So unless it's biblically mandated, I'd be very cautious about using anything that could offend a non-believer or unnecessarily turn them away. So, questions? Thoughts? 3:45, hour and 15 minutes. Is that a go? Any questions? Yes, younger in their walk with the Lord. I invited my father to our men's cell group once, and one of the guys said, it'd be great to have a more mature Christian here. And I said, he's not. He's 70, but he's not more mature Christian. He's, you know, just not, I mean, he's doing okay, but, you know, and it, yeah, that's true. It's not necessarily chronology. Mm-hmm. No. This happens in the context of either, I mean, there may be some courses that they go through and they're going to hear it there too, but in the discipling relationships, in our conversations, which are private, there aren't non-believers there in that. Now, in a home church teaching, you know, I'm reading 1 Thessalonians 1, and I see this church that explodes off the map, almost literally. I'm going to sit there and describe what happened and how it happened. But even the non-Christian sitting there is, I'll try to word it in a manner they understand. That's what this really is about. And I don't have any problem if a non-Christian comes up and says to me, so really what this is about, or at least one big part of it, is you trying to convert me. I mean, imagine that just hard-hitting question. I'd sit there and go, oh, absolutely. I think the greatest gift I could give to you is helping you come to an eternal relationship with the God of the universe. And I believe just about anybody I've ever reached out to, they'd look at that and they'd go, that makes sense. And they wouldn't be offended as long as there's not manipulation and things of that nature. But I still think the Christianese thing, which is on here, and I didn't, you know, when we start using words like sanctify and glorify and justify in our sharing and teaching and, you know, prayer, man, why not say what it means? Why not say God transforming our character, sanctify? God viewing us as righteous. There, I'm about to say a Christianese word, as fully moral even in our immoral state, you know, forgiving our sins. That it's that kind of thing. Oh boy, that just really bugs me when Christians talk like we're the only ones in the room. We can often say most hard-hitting things, just leave the biblical terminology out of it when it's Christian-only kind of terminology. Mm-hmm. That takes work, too. Yeah.
I'm a loner. I've been a
Well, I'm going to presume by your fantastic humility there that you want to. So typically, the first thing is I wonder if the person wants to. So I ask them that, and I ask it not in an accusing tone. I really want to know where their heart is. And if they're like you, one of the things, and I mean, there's really a long answer, and there's elements of self-protection often involved with being introverted that's only answered by Romans 6 through 8, our identity truths. And I would typically counsel somebody to try to find those identity truths and actually work with them on that and how to appropriate their identity. That gets to the deeper stuff. On a practical level, really the last part of appropriating our new identity, I would be encouraging to latch yourself. You're a woman. You're in our home group. I'd sit there and say, attach yourself to my wife or somebody like her and figure out how she gets into those conversations. Listen particularly to those opening comments. Then come back and report to me because I'm still trying to figure it out too. You know, but I find when we take a mini step of, you know, Lord, I'm serious. It scares the daylights out of me, but I'm serious about this. I really want to be more of a spokesperson for you. And we take a mini step like that. He sits there and just, his grace means he gives disproportionate blessing. The next thing you know, you open your mouth on another conversation. You're going to try to ask a question like Chris did, and you do, and you have the greatest night of your life, and then you find out later that that same woman you talked to went home with their friend that brought them and said, oh, I just can't get over her. She was like the nicest person, etc. And they're coming back because they talked with you.
This presentation is copyrighted, but you may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.